listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. My guest this week is comedian Rich Scheidner. He's written an excellent book called Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 1980s Comedy Explosion. Rich Scheidner was there in front of all those brick walls in all the towns in America, working alongside Robin Williams, Steve Martin, Jay Leno, Sam Kinison, and Andy Kaufman. And now he's here to talk about it. Rich Scheidner, also known as Not the Rock Band You Came to See, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you, man.
So this book, which is also a pop music lyric trivia quiz.
That's right.
It's more than just a personal memoir of an era. I mean, you really gave it, it's the history of the art form that we call stand-up. So how did stand-up comedy begin? Was Frank Fay like the first?
No, not even close. I'll give you an exclusive here because I'm writing a screenplay about him. The first stand-up comic was Artemus Ward. He was a lecturer, a humorous lecturer. This is, now, you have to define stand-up comedy, but by defining it as the way I do is, you know, an individual who goes in front of an audience alone with the sole purpose of making them laugh, with the audience expecting the same. That's pretty much what I go with.
That's stand-up.
That's stand-up comedy. And Artemus Ward started doing this in the Civil War, and then actually met Mark Twain, who was Samuel Clemens at the time, and Samuel Clemens started doing it inspired by Artemus Ward at almost exactly the same time Artemus Ward was dying of tuberculosis in England. It's a great story. I'm working on it right now.
So do you know?
But he's lost the history.
Do you know the material, the kind of material that Artemus Ward used?
Well, he was very deadpan in his style. He wrote jokes. He had great ideas. He had great conceptual ideas. He was a very, very funny guy. Totally the personality of a comedian. And he was just his deadpan was his style. In fact, I didn't know about him. I thought Mark Twain might have been the first stand-up, remembering his, when I was sort of researching the history of stand-up. My book only covers the 80s, right? But when I was really at one time researching, writing a book about the history of stand-up comedy in general, and I thought it must have been Mark Twain and his humorous lectures back in the late 19th century that he started doing them then. And then
he was copying Hal Holbrook.
Pardon?
He was copying Hal Holbrook, I thought. Oh, I got that
right. That's right. He was exactly. Anyway, he wrote an essay about Artemus Ward, and that made me start to research him, and I went, oh, here's the guy. This is the guy. He did something radical. So anyway, it you know, late 19th century, vaudeville came in, then stand-up started really doing it. Frank Fay, what he was noted for really was making the MC. He was the MC at the Palace Theater in New York, which was the place to perform in vaudeville in the early part of the 20th century. He made the MC the star turn. He made it the star position. And he was sort of someone who really excelled at and sort of pioneered crowd work. He was very sharp-witted, very quick on his feet. And he dressed well. He sort of did away with it. And he wasn't the only guy doing it, but he really put the nail in it. He got away from the baggy pants comedian sort of broad comedy and more into that sharp wise guy, New York wise guy sort of style of comedy, sarcasm.
Well, one of my favorite little episodes in your book that I think is relevant is when you ran into Maury Amsterdam. I think it was at Cantor's.
You almost made me do a spit take. You really did. I'm going to drink some coffee. That's one of my favorite chapters too. And, you know, Maury Amsterdam, to me, I mean, we were over Cantor's back in the early 80s, right on the corner of Fairfax and the Improv on Melrose, and we'd eat there late at night, and we'd have some drinks. They served alcohol, and we were already drinking, so. And one night, we'd see Maury Amsterdam with a bunch of other older guys. He was in his 70s then, had to be in his 70s. And we just knew him as Buddy Sorrell from, you know, the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Right.
That's all I knew. I mean, that's how ignorant I was, really. But we wanted to go over and say hello to him. You know, hey, you know, it's Buddy, man. We all, you know, the comics, we were we grew up with him. So we go over to his table, and we're like, hey, Maury, man. Hey, guys, how you doing? So, yeah, we're comics. We're young guys. We work over at the Improv there. But he goes, yeah, I go over there once in a while. You guys are great. That's terrific. Yeah, we do stand-up comedy, but we don't do it like you guys did. Oh, really? No, what do you do? Well, you know, we talk about our lives. We don't just do, like, jokes. No, tell me one of the things you do. Tell me one of my jokes. Yeah, that was done by Ricky Gregg Jr. in 1937. And he does the joke to how it was done then. Every time we did one of our jokes, he told us how it was done 30, 40, 50 years ago.
There's nothing new. It's all just recycled.
Yeah, and you know what? He got me into really. And Phyllis Diller, when I met Phyllis, like
Yes, you had very kind things to say about her. I say you had very kind things to say about her.
She was great. She was, you know, the first female star stand-up. I mean, she was the Jackie Robinson or whatever you want to call it of women stand-ups. I mean, she was anyway.
Yeah.
I started studying the history of it, and I found out that, you know, Maury Amsterdam, I mean, in fact, I think I wrote in the story, like a night or two later, I went and told Bud about my running into Maury Amsterdam, and he laughed. He pulled me over to what we used to call the adult table at the Improv. There were guys like Carl Reiner, and these guys would hang around. And young comics, you'd be like invitation only, you know. Harvey Korman, all these stars would hang around with Bud at this table, and he pulled me over and he told me to tell him the story, and I tell him the story, and they all howled laughing. All these old guys, how they go, he ran into a buzzsaw. You know, Maury Amsterdam, he wrote almost all those jokes. I mean, you know. And they started talking about how he, you know, would sell jokes to Milton Berle, the same joke over and over again, and Milton wouldn't know it was the same joke. and then I did some research on Maury Amsterdam. I found out, you know, he wrote for Will Rogers.
Wow.
Back in the 30s, the guy's been around forever. I mean, he had one of the first TV shows. You know, the guy was, you know.
Yeah, I know some comics of that era, they had like a, you know, they had like a card library where they had all their jokes and all the different possibilities of jokes, and they were put in categories and stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, they really were librarians of jokes.
Yeah, well, you know, I wrote it in, I think, the two big eras for stand-up comedy were the late 50s, early 60s, that revolution that Lenny Bruce and Mort saw, Bob Newhart and all those guys led, you know, where what the comics said became important. It became artistic, you know, it mattered.
Yeah.
What the comics said became part of who the comic was instead of just like doing random shtick.
Right.
And then the 80s when it became, you know, it went from being like a side dish, stand-up comedy, sort of like a side dish, to becoming like the main meal. It became really an industry. It became a possible profession.
Well, it's interesting because I know you love and know popular music and rock and roll because of the chapter titles. By the way, people, this book, Kicking Through the Ashes by Rich Scheidner, that's about 350 pages. It's got like 700 chapters in it.
I try to make them quick and easy, you know. It's really meant for the bathroom. It's a bathroom book. You can go fast.
I didn't find that. I found it to be a real great read.
You.
But the each chapter title has a almost all of them have lyrics from
every one
songs.
Of them.
And
every one of them.
Yeah. So like what you were just saying about it was the comic and what he was saying rather than the joke, and that's kind of true with popular music, right? I mean, in the era of Al Jolson, Bing Crosby, and Frank Sinatra. Everybody,
you know, you're right.
Everybody recorded the same song, and it was just you bought the version that you liked. Whereas, you know, when the Beatles and Mick Jagger and Bob Dylan came along, it was the singer, not the song. So the same thing happens in comedy at that moment.
It was around the same time, too. It's funny you said that. It was around the same time, early 60s, you know, with Bob Dylan and all that. You're right. It was just, it used to be they'd buy a song from somebody, a songwriter. Somebody wrote the song and somebody else sang. Then it became the same person who wrote the song sang it. You're right.
So let me ask you this, as long as we're talking about that. Did you ever employ writers, or did you always write your own when you were doing stand-up? You wrote your own material always, or did you?
Yeah, I got some jokes from different people. I'd say probably Tony Visick, who lives in Phoenix now and teaches stand-up comedy, probably wrote more jokes that I used from somebody else than anybody else, probably four or five jokes over the years. But I get, you know, some jokes. John Pate gave me a great joke I used on Tonight Show once. But no, I wrote all my own other than that. There were some random jokes that people got, but I never used any writers per se.
I saw George Carlin in Vegas once. And one of the things that shocked me about him was that he would say, in a kind of a different voice than his own speaking voice, he would say, now I would like to do a piece of material for you called, and then, you know, whatever the title was, baseball versus football, and then go into it, rather than, you know, maintain the illusion that he was just simply talking.
It was conversational, because that's what Lenny Bruce and those guys brought to the art form, making it conversational.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, and guys like Mark Maron and now and those guys who have taken it to another degree. It's hard to tell when they're performing or when they're just like talking to somebody. Yeah, you're right. George Carlin would do that, but he wrote his pieces out, like almost, and then performed them verbatim to how he wrote them.
Right.
And he came from that era when it was a transitional thing, you know, where they used to do these bits. I mean, Lenny Bruce did block bits, like Palladium or Father Flotsky or whatever. He did set pieces, The Lone Ranger. You're right. I mean, it wasn't all just conversational.
Right.
It was a transition, but George Carlin did come from that era. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, if you know how he wrote and his process, and then you watch his specials or whatever, you can see him performing a piece almost verbatim the way he wrote it. You can see it.
Interesting. And
I think most comics today, they'll have an idea, and then they have to work out the setup and the punchline. They have to work out the timing through performance. But George Carlin once told me that I write them out. I write these things out, and then I memorize it and perform it.
I'm sure
he changed.
You know, that era of the comedy record that you and I grew up with, you know, and those wonderful albums by, you know, of course, Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks and Shelley Berman. I like committed to memory all of Shelley Berman's.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, those were obviously routines, but they still seemed so natural. That was kind of there. Well, Mort Saul, I mean, it was hard to believe that Mort Saul had written his material, but I guess he did.
Yeah, he did, and he like you're saying, I mean, here's the guy. He's very conversational, his performance, very low-key. It wasn't, you know, what was going on, and you got to look at these guys, what was accepted stand-up, what was the popular stand-up at the time was the Milton Berle, Jack Carter, Big Banana kind of comics, you know. They come out, they really perform it and wow it, you know, like put big spin on it. And then, you know, he comes out, he's not even wearing a suit, he's got a sweater on, and he's just like talking to you. It was a totally radical style of comedy.
Yeah, I saw Sinatra a number of times, and he always had a comic open for him. Sometimes it was Jan Murray and others. He had other comics that opened for him. They were rarely...
Charlie Callis.
Yeah, Charlie Callis.
Tom Dreesen.
Tom Dreesen. Yeah. They were not particularly funny, usually. I didn't find them funny, but maybe it's a generational thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be a generational thing for sure. I mean, that's, you know, he was of a different generation, what he found funny and who he found funny. And look, another thing is, you're not going to put opening acts, and that's the danger of becoming an opening act. You become an opening act. Opening acts are safe. You got to have somebody safe. You don't want somebody angering the audience. You want Bill Hicks as your opening act. You don't want somebody coming out who's going to challenge them. You know, you want something safe.
Yeah.
You know, if a comic hires another comic as an opening act, you can bet that comic's not that funny. I hate to tell them that, but they're not hiring them because they're killers, okay? A guy's going like, hey, I opened for this guy. He hired you because you're going to bring them in the vicinity of funny.
Get them warmed up to laugh, but not laugh them out. You were saying there's a certain amount of laughter in the room, and you were afraid that your opening act could sap all the laughter out of the room.
Yeah, look, I know some people, like, you know, they don't worry about it, but, you know, there's really only so many good laughs in the room, and the audiences laugh out. People, they're not in shape to laugh. It takes a lot of energy to laugh. I mean, how many times have people come to comics after the show and going, oh my God, my sides ache, my face hurts. I mean, if you run them properly, and that's the way I used to look at it. I used to look at it like I'm running the audience. And every once in a while when I'm running them, I've got to let them breathe a little bit. I have to slow it down, let them breathe a little bit, then run them again. But the end result is I want them coming up to me and going, I haven't laughed like that in years. Oh my God, my sides hurt. Good, that's what I want. But there's only so much of that in them. I mean, they can't laugh for 3 hours. Not
right.
Killer laughter, you know, like heads rocking back and forth, pounding the table.
Yeah, they could injure themselves.
No, they got so much in them, you know, but whatever.
Well, I once saw Perry Como, and I think it was 1978. I went to see Perry Como, and the opening act was a comic, one that you speak highly
Jay
of.
Leno.
Jay Leno.
I thought it was
right?
Jay Leno.
That's right.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, and some of the younger comics, I put that story in there specifically. because some of the younger comics, they would go, well, you know, he was just like this middle of the road sort of, you know, middle-aged talk show host is what they know him as. But when we first started, you know, back in the early 80s, he was a killer. I mean, he really was. I mean, comics would come in the room to watch him. He just pounded an audience, pounded them. He was so tight, and he had that bellowing voice, and he's just one of those guys built for it. He's just natural stand-up comic, and he would kill the clubs or every room you go to. I was always like, I'd go into a room the first time I do a comedy club. I'd go, what's the record here? I want to know who had done the longest on stage. And I wanted to beat it, you know, whatever it was, hour and 45, 2 hours, whatever it was. I'm going to go longer than that. I'm going to set the record. And you come in, they go, hey, Jay Leno just did 3 hours. 3 hours? Oh, he must have locked the doors. It must have been like, you know, it must have been like a Wagnerian opera. Lock the doors, you're not getting out. No. No, Jay did like four ovations. They brought him back 4 times. You know, it's like, oh, man.
I can actually remember one of the jokes that he told opening for Barry Gumo. He said that he had gotten a coupon in the mail for a free hot dog, and then he was telling you, what the FDA was allowing people to put in hot dogs, how much you know rat feces and something was acceptable, and he goes, and that's in a hot dog that's for sale. Imagine what they would put in a free hot dog.
That's a hot dog just for sale. I know that joke. I remember that joke. I do, so.
Now, I think I heard, I'm not sure if it was Woody Allen or Steve Martin, or both, actually, I think. They said that they didn't like to perform for an audience that was stoned because they couldn't trust the laughter, that the laughter was genuine because they would laugh at anything.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, same thing with audience and me. You know, they're drinking. You know, everybody knows they get a little looser, a little bit less inhibited, but comics want to know that what they're doing is truly funny. I mean, we calibrate our performances by the audience. And I think I wrote in there one time, the first time I ever met Robin Williams was at the Improv in New York, 1979. I was the MC. So they go, hey, Robin Williams is here, bring him up. Well, it's a packed room. The room was whatever, 250, whatever room amount of people is in the room. And I bring Robin Williams up. And this is the height of Robin Williams' stardom, when he just broke, you know, huge. 1979. He was, him and Steve Martin, Richard Pryor were the biggest comics, right? And he destroys the Improv in New York. I mean, you know, 45 minutes, everything he did, they laughed at. Every move, every gesture, everything. And then he comes off stage, and of course, I bring up the next act who's, you know, who's just performing in a wasteland. I mean, the crowd's destroyed. And I'm standing in the back, knowing I got to go up any second because the comic's going to bail or whatever. And Robin's standing next to me. And he didn't say it to me. He just sort of said it to himself. He was like stunned. He was like, I don't know what's funny anymore. They're laughing at everything.
Yeah.
And I got what he was saying. I'd never had that experience where they laughed so much. I didn't know it was funny anymore. But I get why that was a problem.
Well, you were saying that you were at a comedy club that they were speaking Japanese and you didn't understand a word they were saying, but you still laughed because people were laughing.
That's right. That's why. It was a Montreal Just for Laughs festival, you know, and they have a French version that was it was French. Yeah, same thing. Right. I didn't understand a word. I found myself laughing.
Because if it's popular and, you know, you don't want to be left out of the joke and people are laughing and...
Well, you laugh because other people are laughing. It just becomes infectious. But, yeah, you're right. That's right.
And with Robin Williams, he was so popular that he could do no wrong. I mean, the same sort of thing happened with Steve Martin, right? I mean, the first time I ever saw Steve Martin, he was the opening act for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band at the Tribune.
Oh, my God, you saw him back then.
Yeah. And
that's a silver and turquoise Steve Martin.
No one knew that he was a comic because we went to see the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and here comes this guy, and he's smiling, and he's playing the banjo. So we figured, oh, you know, he's going to play some music. And he's smiling and he's playing, and then he reaches over and he takes a drink of water, and he's still, the banjo doesn't stop playing even though he stopped. And that was like the first indication. So all of the things that he did that later became iconic, you know, putting the arrow through his head and the balloon animals and all those things, were completely fresh and new and so funny. Then later, when those things became the thing you expected and he was doing it in a stadium, you know, audiences would laugh, or you were saying in your book, that the audience would say the punchlines along with him.
Yeah, yeah. They were, I saw the same thing, but I didn't see him as early as you did, but I saw him, I think it was like 76, 75 or 76 in D.C. at the Kennedy Center. I don't think it was sold. I remember seeing it. A friend of mine took me. I wasn't really aware of him that much. Friend took me, and I was like, oh, wow, he's great. And it was like, you know, a year or two later, I was at the Capitol Center, which was, I think, about 14,000 people. And what you said was what was happening. People, it was like they were yelling out the punchlines. It became, that was part of the thing, was like, it was like a rock audience, you know, like where they sing along with the Stones or something. They were actually singing along with his punchlines. And he told me, when I worked with him on Roxanne, the movie Roxanne, he said that's one of the reasons why he got out of it, because he no longer was performing comedy. He was sort of like the maestro, you know, at a concert. He was just orchestrating it.
Yeah, it was a love-in that he was the middle of.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're chatting with comedian Rich Scheidner, whose new book is Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 1980s Comedy Explosion. You were talking in your book about the kind of the other side of the audience being stoned. When you and a bunch of comedians went on an acid trip to kind of search for comedy, to mine comedy out of that great...
Yeah. Yeah. Every comic's looking for the great Northwest Passage, you know, the shortcut. And we thought that would be it, because every time we did acid, we were just laughing so much. And same with mushrooms, you know, we're so funny, you know. And of course, we didn't realize that we were being exactly what we didn't like about an audience that was stoned. We were too easy. We didn't even realize that. So we said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to tape our next acid trip together. We're going to tape it, and we'll have so much new material. It'll be unbelievable. And, of course, it happens. We tape, and we ended up with, like, you know, 4 or 5 90-minute tapes. I don't know who even had the wherewithal when a tape ended to change tapes or whatever. I don't know. But anyway, we have them. And we get together the next day or whatever, a day later, 2 days later, whatever, we get together to divvy up this treasure chest full of new material. And, of course, the first thing that happens, somebody says on the tape, you hear somebody say, open the windows. And then there's just, like, 10 minutes of laughter.
That's funny
and
stuff.
Somebody else, yeah, that's right. It's hilarious. I mean, who wants to open the window joke? I mean, who wants that? It's a setup and a punchline in one word, one or 4 words, whatever. So there was nothing there. There was nothing.
That was not so fruitful a mining.
Yeah, no.
But you know, an interesting thing about that Steve Martin phenomenon or whatever. You said in your book a couple of things, like you didn't, once you've used a joke, especially if you'd used it on TV, you felt like, well, I've used that and I must do something new every time, as opposed to Steve Martin, who did this sort of those same routines over and over. Although he always added
fresh
things. Well,
also, I never had 16,000 people paying to see me. I believe I would have done every other joke that they wanted.
But like, you know, Burns and Allen, they toured vaudeville for like 40 years doing lamb chops without changing a word of it. And, you know, and when you're on TV, then you feel like everybody has seen it. But maybe they're not paying that close attention.
No, they're not. And sometimes, you know, you think you did a Tonight Show that everybody has seen it because it's done a Tonight Show. But very few people who come into the comedy club have seen you do the joke. Very few. And sometimes the ones who did, they brought people in because they wanted them to see you do that material. Like, that's what they were telling.
Did you ever have people, you know, yell out a request? Do the Pat
yeah.
Robinson bit.
Yeah. And I used to play off of that, too, because it'd be like, you know, it's like people yelling out to Elvis Presley, you know. It's like people yelling out. I mean, comics don't normally get that jukebox feeling, but it is. People would do it, and I would do the bit, but I'd have to play around before I got to the bit, because you just couldn't come right out and do the bit, because the whole audience goes, oh, here comes the bit. You know, you don't want the audience expecting the joke. I mean, since comedy is so much the surprise, you had to, like, sneak around and get back to the bit somehow without them seeing it coming.
I want to ask you about Johnny Carson, since we just mentioned him. You know, he's kind of an enigmatic personality. There's been a lot of written about him lately. What was your experience?
Well, you know, I had a couple of, you know, I did, I think, totally about 14 of them. And the second one I did, I wrote it in the book, I got in trouble because I changed the material I was supposed to do. You know, I just ended up changing the material. And, but I got the approval from the booker, but, Johnny didn't like the jokes. I got in big trouble. I got in trouble. You know, I mean, you know, that never lost sight of the fact that, that we were there to make Johnny laugh. You know, and it was sort of a truly a throwback jester kind of jester make the king laugh. He was the king of comedy, and we were there to entertain his audience, but also him too. And I,
he was like the arbiter of what was going to be funny.
Yeah, he was. He was. And but you wanted to make him laugh. And if he found you funny, wow, man. I mean, you know, the britches were there for the taking for any comic who did great there. And I did find, I think the biggest part to me about Johnny Carson was I made him laugh doing something off the cuff. I was supposed to do a panel, but there wasn't enough time. So I looked over and I saw him give me the ring finger, you know, circle and, you know, the sort of the A-OK sign. Which meant I wasn't going to be doing panels. So instead of just turning and walking to the curtain as the audience applauded and disappearing, I backed up like a gunfighter. I pulled my hand back, you know, like I had a gun on my hip and my jacket back. And I backed away and looked at the audience kind of warily, you know, like I was leaving a saloon or something. And Johnny laughed. And you could hear him laugh on the tape. And Ed McMahon goes, "What's he doing?" And Johnny goes, "He's doing a gunfighter. It's great." And my dad, who I knew, you know, he watched every Tonight Show. He called me up. The first time he called me up that I'd done Tonight Show, it was the first time he called me up and said, "You know, you made Johnny laugh. You're really good at this." So that was huge for me.
I saw Robin Williams twice. Once he was fantastic, so funny, side-splittingly great. And then another time he was off. It wasn't going well at all. And then you could see him kind of digging in for material that was, you know, more shocking, not necessarily blue because he's blue all the time, but you know, more racially motivated or whatever. I don't know. So what about you? Did you ever have that? You know, when you're bombing, not that you ever bomb, but what's that experience like to be on stage?
Yeah, there is. Look, you know, sometimes it's sort of like that. You know, you're going in, you just turn like the mission into a kamikaze mission. You know, you go, okay, all right, we're going in. I'm taking it in. I'm not going to just go into the ocean. I'm going to take this into the ship. I'm going down anyway. So there is that kind of attitude of like, okay, well, I'm going to go down. I'm going to let them know that I was here. You know, I've done that.
Is bombing like the worst experience that you could
have? No, it's the worst. It's the worst. And, you know, everybody goes through it where you're just off. You know, you come off. I had to learn. You know, I'd come off. Even the shows that went well, audience people would come up to me after the show. They go, "Hey, that was great." I go, no, it wasn't that great. You know, I made a mistake here, made a mistake that. And then I'd see the smile leave their face. I realized I was just ruining their experience. So I had to learn to keep my mouth shut and just go, "Yeah, thank you. It was great. Thank you." But there were those times when everybody knows. I mean, I think Jerry Seinfeld said that. I mean, it's one of those few jobs where everybody knows exactly how you're doing at any given moment. There's no fool in the audience. They know if you're bombing, you're bombing. You know you're bombing. So, I mean, you try to save it. You try to figure out a way to pull it out. But if you can't, you go, okay, well, I'm going to find something else here. Maybe I'll just, you know, you got to go. You're trying to find the audience is what you're doing, really. You know, you're trying to find out where are they. If they're not going for this material, let's try that material. And you go, well, maybe they want really, you know, maybe I can get them going if I really shocked them. I don't know what Rob was thinking, but I understand it. I do understand it.
Yeah. And what kind of material, I mean, I know from your book that you were a very successful stand-up comic, and I remember you, and I'm sure a lot of casual stand-up comedy fans remember you too, but there's probably a large number of people. So it's, you know, it's kind of like this. When I was a kid, I used to love to read books about the golden age of vaudeville and stuff, and that was something that had happened, you know, like 30 years ago. And that's what's happening here. You've written a book about events that happened 30 years ago. So
that's right.
I think there's a lot of people who haven't heard of you and don't remember you. What was your act like? What kind of material did you do? Did you do impressions?
No, I didn't. I never felt like I was a great performer. Like I had limited skills. I could do my voice, a really bad female voice, and then a really deep, sort of a masculine voice that was sort of like my joke voice, you know, like George Carlin would do that Brooklyn guy, you know, for his goofy, dumb voice that was the joke voice. So I only had like 3 years, really, and I was loud, but I did go at him hard. I did perform hard. I went after the laugh. There was no, like, question what I was up there to do. But I love the right. I love that part of it. And I like to, you know, talk about men and women relationships became my thing. I wrote in the book there, you know, at one point, Rodney Dangerfield gave me that advice, and Phyllis Diller later said, you know, listen to the audience. That's why you tape yourself, you know, not just to correct the timing of a joke, but see what they're laughing at. And what they're laughing at, do more of that. And I just noticed the audiences didn't laugh as much with me when I did social material or topical political material. But when I ended up talking about being in a relationship, I got big laughs. So I did more of that. So that's ended up being more things that I did more than anything else, probably.
And did your own personal relationships play into it? Or did you have to
Always. Always.
Uh-huh. So that what was going on in your life informed your comedy?
Yeah. You know, when I first started doing it, you know, when I first started doing stand-up comedy, most comics were doing jokes about dating, you know, the bad blind dates. There were a lot of blind date jokes and breakup jokes. Those were the two main jokes everybody was doing, because most comics would play, I'm just single up here, and so I'm lonely, I just broke up with a girl, which was really just fishing in the audience for any woman. And then there was the bad blind dates, bad dates. And I was in a relationship. I was always in relationships. So I said, I just got to talk about being in a relationship. That's where I was. So I just talked about that.
Now, you were in a relationship with another stand-up comic.
Yeah.
Was that a bad idea?
Not at the time. At the time, it seemed like a great idea, like a lot of things I did. It seemed like a fantastic idea. But, you know, look, you stand up back then, we were young comics. You know, our schedules were, we'd get home from the clubs at 3 and 4 in the morning. We wouldn't go to sleep till 5 in the morning. You know, who else is up with you then? Who else is keeping these vampire hours? So most comics were male, so they either dated a waitress or another comic. There weren't that many female comics. There were very few female comics. So I met a female comic, Carol Leifer, and we started dating, and then we got married because it seemed like the next thing to do, I guess, or just get that out of the way. Maybe for both of us, let's just get this out of the way. Everybody was, you know, our family expects, we're not going to be the professionals you wanted us to be, the accountants, whatever, but we'll get married. Here you go. See, we got married. There you go. I don't know. We did it. We had a wedding, and we got married, and then we got divorced.
How long were you married? I mean, you didn't get divorced the next day. You were married for a couple of years.
Yeah, we got married for 4 or 5 years, but you got to remember, a couple of comics on the road, so actual real-time marriage was probably less than a year. The actual time we were actually together in the same place.
7 days.
I don't know. Yeah, 7 days. But, it's tough. We're both ambitious. We're both really all about our career and competitive. And
as she got more successful, was that more difficult for you?
I never really felt like I had a problem with that. I'll be honest with you. She was successful when I met her. She was, she was more established in the New York comedy scene than I was when I first met her. I moved up there from D.C. in 79. She was pretty well established. She did the Letterman show before me. I did the Carson show before her. But other than that, you know, she did a TV pilot before. I mean, she was pretty successful. So I didn't feel like that was a problem, that part of it. But it's hard. You know, look, who knows? We gave it our best shot. What can you say?
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're chatting with comedian Rich Scheidner, whose new book is Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 1980s Comedy Explosion. And it's an interesting book because it's not an autobiography. I mean, you don't tell me everything about you. It's mostly about the experience of being in comedy.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I find very fascinating. But, of course, now that I've spent this time with you reading your book, you know, I want to know more about you, and I want to help you.
I'm beyond help. Look, I call, when they go, somebody said, you're still doing comedy? I said, yeah, it's my Circling the Drain tour. I appreciate it, man. Look, I wanted to write a book where I covered every aspect of stand-up comedy, so I wanted to hit the history of 80s comedy, but I wanted to cover, you know, everything that the comics do, the heckling, the writing, every joke stealing, everything that we deal with, I wanted to cover.
Talk a little bit about that joke stealing. That, I found that to be very fascinating. You know, there was once a guy who, you were saying there's a guy who, if he there were levels of which he would, you would know how much of your act he had stolen by what he offered you.
Oh, Ollie Joe Prater. This was a joke. It wasn't my joke, but it was a joke going around. He was a famous road comic. And so he said, if Ollie Joe came up and bought you a drink, that means he just did one of your jokes. If Ollie Joe shared a joint with you, that means he did a couple of your jokes. If Ollie Joe offered you a line of cocaine, that means you just played Cleveland. So there were guys who were, you know, you look, most comics are either better at writing or better at performing. And the ones that are purely really great performers aren't good writers. They either have to, you know, do old material, right, which really wasn't working, you know, that way. You can't just go with old joke books, especially back in the 80s. Or they had to buy material. Most comics didn't have that much money to buy really good material. Or they had to borrow, steal, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that happened, you know. It just happened. And there really wasn't anything to do. You just had to write new material. You just had to keep writing new material. And I had that one story in the book about a guy who, you know, I was working with him all week. He was the middle act. You know, I always would check out the middle act and see what material they were doing. So if I had to avoid anything that was close, I would avoid it when I was headlining it. The last night, man, I would always wear headphones and listen to music to get ready for the show. And I watched him perform. I just took my headphones off to see where he was in his act, right, to know how much time was left. And I heard him do one of my jokes, then another one of my jokes. Then he did a whole bunch of my jokes. I was like, oh, my God, he's going. And I got to go on stage.
And he was doing your entire act.
He was
doing
the
act that you were about to do.
Yeah, the one I was about to do. He was doing a bunch of it. And what I realized was, I had just, you know, taken off the headphones like halfway while I was up there. I didn't know what he had done before. Now I knew what jokes to avoid because I heard them, but I didn't know what jokes he'd already done that I didn't hear yet. And
then they would think you were copying him if you did your own material.
Yeah, so that's what happened. I mean, he came off stage and back into the green room and just landed a punchline. They had a little room off to the side there where the comics would sort of get ready to go on stage and then come off the stage. And I grabbed him when he came off. I was like, wait, did you just did my act? And he looked at me, he was like stunned. He was like, oh my God, I forgot you were still here. Like, he was like, I'm going to steal your act, man. I thought you were out of town already. I jumped early, you know.
Yeah. Admitting that he was freely going to steal your act.
Oh,
once
no,
he left
freely. It. There was no question he was going to do it.
And so you can't, there's no, you can't copyright it. You can't.
No, you can't copyright jokes. You know, you can't do anything other than write new material. And it happens, you know. And look, it's not even just a pure absolute, just a joke. I mean, comics will come up with somebody, who's the first comic that realized, wait, like airline jokes, right? We all say, oh, airline jokes. But way back in the day, only a few people flew commercial airline, right? So there weren't enough people flying where you could do that material in a nightclub back in the 50s or whatever, where somebody go, oh, we all get what it's like now to fly. We all have that experience. So there was some comic who first tried doing airline material, and the audience laughed, and the other comics went, oh, my God, you could do airline material now.
Yeah.
So even if they just didn't do exactly that comic's act, right, his jokes per se, they started mining that area. They started, it's claim jumping, you know, they just said, okay, everybody, we can do airline jokes now. So everybody started creating their version of his airline jokes.
Well, it's kind of like what you were saying with Maury Amsterdam, that is pretty much every joke has been done in some, it's like Shakespeare. It's been
yeah,
done
in some way, but there's always something, you know, I mean, Maury would admit, I mean, probably those airline jokes were some sort of version of...
The Pullman train joke.
Good reference.
But
all the train jokes. Good reference. I was stumbling for a wagon train joke. The Pullman was perfect.
Well, Shelley Berman, I know he did. I think he was one of the early ones to do an airplane airline.
Yeah, it might have been him or Alan King or one of those guys. But you're right, you know.
And then you said in your book that Shelley Berman was upset with Bob Newhart for taking the telephone routine because
right when in you know in reality there was cone on a telephone that was done in the early when a telephone first came out. There was a guy named Joe Hyman. There were comics who did routines about the telephone.
George Jessel. George Jessel had Hello Mama.
Yeah, they all did you know material back then about using the telephone because calling their mother on the phone, and the mother couldn't understand them, and she didn't know how to work the telephone, and she was all, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
There was a lot of, like, talking to mother on the telephone stuff. Yeah.
We're talking with Rich Scheidner, and his new book is called Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 1980s Comedy Boom. And you talk about some of the people who you think were the most innovative, and you spent some time talking about Sam Kinison. Can you share a little bit of that?
Yeah, you know, Sam, I knew Sam before. I knew Sam before, and we hung out a lot before he became big in 85. In the summer of 85, he sort of exploded, and he made anger a commodity. He made anger a comedic commodity. He's one of those guys who influenced the art form, which sort of changed the direction. Because before Sam, everybody was trying to get on Tonight Show. Everybody was working clean. Pretty much everybody was working clean and conversational. And Sam came out with this. It was, you know, obviously mock anger, but it was very funny. And the way he did it, other people started doing it. Everybody's act got a little louder and a little angrier after Sam came out. George Carlin admitted clearly in his book, The Last Word, he said, you know, he was very influenced by Sam Kinison after he saw him in the late 80s. Sam influenced George to work a little angrier and a little harder.
George Carlin.
He was wild, man.
George Carlin was obviously influenced by Lenny Bruce, because I think when I first started to see George Carlin, it was almost like he was doing a Lenny Bruce kind of thing.
Yeah. He loved to play with the language, and he avoided, a lot of people avoided the pitfall that really cost Lenny his career, I think, mostly was attacking religion, the institutions. A lot of people after that would do jokes about it, but they did jokes from a believer standpoint instead of Lenny was really just trying to tear the institutions down. He really went after it. I think that was more than the obscenity, because there were people working in the comedy clubs, as I understand it, like B.S. Pulley, who were working as blue material, or bluer than Lenny. But was a Jewish guy making fun of Catholicism, and I think that rubbed some people the wrong way.
I can't imagine why that would be the case.
You can't imagine it being a problem.
When you were a kid, what was the comedy that you responded to? Mad Magazine?
No, man. I that was my generation. We kind of grew up, we were trained on Mad Magazine, then National Lampoon, then Saturday Night Live, and it was definitely National Lampoon was the mad, the things I liked the most in it were like the mad snappy answers, the stupid questions, thing. I loved all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I loved it. And I loved the Honeymooners, Jackie Gleason show. My dad loved watching stand-up comics every time, you know, a stand-up comic came on. You could tell it was important. My dad got real, you know, everybody quiet down and listen to this guy, you know, whoever it was on Ed Sullivan show or whatever.
You have a kind of an Art Carney kind of vibe.
Somebody told me that a few times, and I go, oh, I wouldn't be by accident, because, I mean, I loved Art Carney. I mean, he was as funny as anybody to me on that show, and I liked that whole, the way he moved. I'm sure I'm doing some way to do it.
Yeah, he was a funny actor, not a funny joke teller.
Mm-mm. He was that difference that I can't remember the guy's name, the guy who gave the difference between a comic and a comedian. But he said things in a funny way instead of saying funny things, which is what a comedian is. But the guy who Edwin had that statement, I think, that definition.
I was watching, some late night talk show, and Henny Youngman was on, and he told this joke. These two guys meet, and one guy says, I got a new hearing aid. It's the best kind made. Cost me $25,000. Really? What kind is it? Oh, it's about a quarter to two. Then, about a week later, I was watching, I think it was Carson, and Art Carney was on, and he told that same joke, but it took him about 5 minutes to tell it.
Well, he didn't remember as many jokes as...
That's right.
Any Youngman, so he had to stretch his one joke out longer.
Oh, you said in your book once that you told the same joke, like, right after you told it, and then you told it again.
I've done that. I think that's pretty much one of every comic's fear. It happened. I started doing three show nights You know, we do three shows in one night on Saturday nights in the comedy clubs. And that was the danger, you know, of repeating a joke. And you look out at the audience, man, you do the joke, and you see them staring at you, and there's a look on their face which you have not seen before. Their face is like, and you go, did I just do the joke? And they all go, yeah. At that point, there's no longer any kind of whiff that you're just making this stuff up the top of your head. There's no longer any kind of like, oh, he's just having a conversation. No, there's an act. I'm doing an act, and I did the joke twice. Yeah.
Well, now you took a break from stand-up, but now you're doing stand-up again. People could see you.
Yeah. Yeah, I love doing it. I love it.
Where do you play these days?
Well, again, it's all age appropriate. You know, I do some comedy clubs, a few. Zanies in Chicago, or done the Laughing Skull in Atlanta. There's a few places I still do. Comedy Magic Club here in Hermosa Beach. But mostly, it's I'm doing casinos like the Borgata in Atlantic City, or the Laugh Factory in Vegas, or those places. Cruise ships and country clubs. Those are the places I go now.
And you'll be writing another book soon.
Yeah, this next book won't be per se. This will be a lot about. It won't be a book about stand-up comedy, though.
Well, you've done it. It's a great book, Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 1980s Comedy Boom. Rich Scheidner, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Guy. Thank you very much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Rich Scheidner. His book is called Kicking Through the Ashes, My Life as a Stand-Up in the 1980s Comedy Explosion. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Join me next week when I talk with impressionist Rich Little.